Today's theme is El Salvador, passion for freedom. And also thought it could be passion for peace also, because I'll be talking a little about what the Salvadorans, and including in particular, perhaps especially the churches, are doing to call for peace. And I'll show a few slides about some of the activities around that call for peace. But to start off the day, I thought I'd sing a few songs. Passion for anything in El Salvador is frequently expressed through the arts. Salvadorans are very gifted and very inspired, perhaps because of the situation in which they live, to be creative in music and dance, drama, poetry. And for them, the arts are never something which is purely diversionary or used for entertainment purposes, but it's the arts are something which they use to express the passion that they feel for life and for, well, all of the things we've been talking about, for truth, justice, and peace, and freedom, and so on. They do a lot of talking. Salvadorans are very articulate. When they're speaking publicly or when they gather in groups to talk about issues like national reality and so on, they use a lot of words, and in their songs they use a lot of words. But sometimes they recognize also that words have limitations, and what they feel, the intensity of their experience, cannot be expressed in words. And so then they use the arts. And it's our experience in Canada, at least in our privilege in Canada, to have many Salvadorans who are maintaining that passion and that treasure in cities throughout our country. I presume in the States it's the same. So there are many dance groups and theater groups and music groups, and composed primarily of Salvadorans, but bringing passion to us also out of their experiences and their traditions. So with that, I'll begin with some songs. Yesterday's theme was passion for life, and so I'll start with a song about passion for life. God is life. The chorus is very simple, and if you want to join in on the chorus as you catch on, please do that. God is life, God gives life, God gives us life, so that we may share life. And the verse is a quotation from Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of us but to do justice, and so on.
Thank you. a couple verses from, one from Luke and one from Acts, to me summarize the kind of commitment that Salvadorans have made in responding to the needs of a very troubled society. That commitment is wrapped up with a dream that they have for peace, for justice, for a society which more closely resembles the reign of God. And this song is the dream. We've got to dream. And the verses which are quoted in, or the scripture verses which are quoted in the verses of the song, are Luke, from Luke 4, Jesus quoting Isaiah, and also Paul's statement or commitment to ministry from Acts 20:28, I believe is the reference. Voices which no longer sing, for the clandestine kiss, for the censured verse, for the exiled youth, for the forbidden names, I name you freedom. And of course, I name you in the name of everyone for your true name. I name you when it grows dark, when no one sees me. I write your name on the walls of my city, your true name, your name and other names which I do not name for fear. For the persecuted idea, for the blows received, for that person who no longer resists, for those who hide themselves, for the fear which grabs you, for your steps over which they keep watch, for the way in which they attack you, for your children whom they kill, I name you freedom. For the invaded lands, for the conquered peoples, for the suppressed people, for exploited men and women, for the dead in the orchard, for the just person treated unjustly, for the assassinated hero, for the fires snuffed out, I name you freedom. And the chorus again, I name you in the name of everyone for your true name. Your name, or I name you when it grows dark, when no one sees me. I write your name on the walls of my city. Your name, your true name, your name and other names which I do not name for fear. It's from Uruguay and not Venezuela, sorry. say the women who know it. We can say that part. And the men who know it sing, Jesus is coming, Jesus is coming, Jesus. Try it on for freedom, please.
In August of 1988 in El Salvador, something was started which has since then had a lot of promise, held a lot of promise and hope for the Salvadoran people. And it's something which, at least in Canada, has received very little, if any, news coverage, which is unfortunate because it's a very large and very well-supported popular movement. It was initiated by Archbishop Riveri Damas, in August of 88. It was an invitation by him for churches and organizations, popular organizations, and, well, every sector of society to join in a national debate for peace. Shortly after that, the leadership kind of moved to leaders of various other churches, including primarily Edgar Palacios of the Baptist Church, Miranda Gomez of the Lutheran Church, Luis Serrano of the Episcopal Church, and there have been some Roman Catholic bishops and priests involved with it, although Rivera y Damas kind of backed away and took a lesser role in it. But very quickly, it grew to an organization, an umbrella movement of about, I think there are now 78 national organizations included in this national debate for peace. And those include the churches, the labor sector, the business sector, the farmers, the women, the students, the indigenous people. It's a very widely based movement. The permanent committee is the organizing group that kind of spearhead all of this now, and that's made up of mostly these church leaders. And every couple of months they plan a major event. It's usually a peace march, and it's sometimes a peace vigil. I've got some pictures of the march, the vigil I don't have pictures of. The vigil would go all through the night, usually in the Metropolitan Cathedral, with the evening filled with cultural programming and speeches and so on, and then everyone continuing with that throughout the night in the cathedral. There's been, at least at the one vigil I attended, there was some military harassment. There were some members of the National Guard who started shooting, and there were two occasions when I think three were injured on each occasion. Apart from that, most of these events have been allowed to proceed in peace. Following the events, there have sometimes been arrests of leaders, especially participants in the parade, in the marches. It was interesting also that, well, internationals living and working in El Salvador are forbidden to participation in any kind of event that might be political. And generally, such events were assumed to be political, and so we were asked to not participate. Sometimes visitors would kind of stand by and watch, and if they were expelled, that was their own problem. But for us working with the church, we would draw negative attention to the church also. So the church asked us to not participate. However, on one occasion, Bishop Gomez went to, I think it was Ponce, the head of the armed forces, and explained to him that this was not a political event, this was a religious event. The March for Peace was a religious event. And he succeeded in persuading Ponce that indeed it was a religious event, and that for that reason internationals could participate. And so we were all out there also, and it was a very moving experience. So these peace marches would be called every couple of months on rather short notice. Like on Monday, you would hear a notice that such an event was to happen on Thursday. In spite of the short notice, they would draw together tens of thousands of Salvadorans from all over the country. Generally, the authorities would get word of this and try to block buses and so on that were coming in from rural areas. So thousands of the rural participants wouldn't necessarily make it in. On some occasions, they would try and come in a day or two ahead of time to beat the military blocks. It was interesting that on most occasions, the Lutheran Church was given leadership position in these marches. The Lutheran Church is very tiny in El Salvador, but it has quite a high profile. And it seemed to be one of the most unified and determined voices calling for negotiation and peace.
What does the banner say?
Okay, the banner says that we Christians have the obligation to pronounce ourselves, to declare ourselves for peace. And the parade route is along both sides of the street. You have mostly single-file marchers with these palm branches decorated with colored paper flowers. Mm-hmm. And then the banners go across the street in the middle. So it's a very orderly and very impressive visual display. Most of these are youth from Fe y Esperanza, from the orphanage where I worked. We'd bring in about 50 or 60 of the children and youth to participate in these events. The church, in its pastoral and prophetic role, has heard the cry of the people in order to bring to light those who sit in darkness and in the shadows of death, and to guide our steps in ways of peace. So these marches are used as opportunities to proclaim the gospel in a setting of death and oppression. There was generally military surveillance of helicopters. On one of the marches, the helicopters circled low overhead throughout the afternoon of speeches and drowned out all of the speeches and raised dust and just tried to disrupt the event. And always the military would be just a block off the parade route, so you'd see thousands of soldiers and vehicles, tanks and so on. Anticipating, like in the media, prior to such events, there would always be warnings about how violent these occasions would be, and how much destruction would happen. Of course, that was never the case. Here's the permanent committee, the leaders of these events. Besides calling and organizing these marches, all the organizers would also see it as a primary responsibility to call people together ahead of time and lead them through workshops to discuss with them what the event was all about, what it meant to call for peace, what negotiation means, what dialogue means. And so from youth to business leaders, to campesinos and peasants, this discussion would happen about the meaning of such an event. And so it was very clear to the participants that it wasn't simply a call for like a ceasefire or an orderly laying down of weapons, but peace would have to include justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. And the oppressed Salvadorans understand that very clearly. But it's a call for a change in the social order, not just an end to the civil war. So more of the Lutheran youth. We're marching past the government center.
What flag is that? They're carrying the blue light?
That's the Salvadoran national flag.
Now, those group of people that were carrying that one particular banner committee, mm-hmm. did you say they were the leaders?
Right.
Wouldn't they be obviously be able to be identified and then possibly arrested on some trumped up charge because they're all together there?
Right, and that happened regularly. And many of them, most of them have received death threats.
I would imagine so. Isn't it also risky to all be together like that? Yes, we are the leaders.
Everything the people do there is risky. Yeah. Probably less so on a big public event like this because there's so many media, so much international attention.
But still,
at least local media.
It seems like they would be able to get them later on.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, certainly after the offensive, all of these leaders were forced into exile because of death threats and so on. And actually, the leader of the Episcopal Church, Luis Serrano, was captured and detained for, I think, 5 weeks. He was released in January, so it was about 5 weeks, and tortured very severely. He's actually a Spaniard, but a naturalized Salvadoran citizen. And he was accused, and he and his church council were accused of having attacked the headquarters of the armed forces, which happened about a week or two before the offensive.
So he, supposedly he and his church council had carried out that attack. And there was never any evidence for that, so eventually he was released.
Is it generally true to say that basically, since they're not calling just for a laying down of arms, but that they're calling for some sort of social justice, that probably from the side of the Arena Party or the conservatives, that they're probably just considered a propagandistic front for the FMLN? I mean, do you think it's that polarized, basically? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the churches, to some extent, not always blatantly, but especially many of the popular organizations, humanitarian organizations, including the UN and others working in the country, the Red Cross, are often accused of being front organizations for the FMLN.
Yeah.
And when we were arrested, that was the charge, or not, we weren't officially charged, but that was the suspicion they named against us, that we were arrested on suspicion of being collaborators with the FMLN. And so that was reason to expel us, or detain, arrest us, and expel us. And while we were being interrogated, they had many other accusations that they brought forward, lists of groups,
sure,
which they wanted me to say we were involved with, or the bishop was involved with.
Yeah.
So after several hours of marching, usually from about 8 till noon, we would gather in Plaza Libertad for an afternoon of speeches. And so the people would gather, the banners were all put up on El Rosario church behind. And here you see the leaders, Mirardo Gomez at the mic, speaking for the Lutherans, well, a Lutheran representing the leadership of the national debate from the committee. Just to Mirardo's right, to our left, with his head down, is Luis Serrano, the head of the Episcopal Church. And on the other side of Mirardo is Edgar Palacios, the Baptist leader of the permanent committee. And a couple others just behind Mirardo are members, pastors of the Lutheran Church. Mirardo is a very outspoken spokesperson for not only the National Debate Committee, but really has become the voice of the people, and many have named him as kind of a successor to Oscar Romero.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you mentioned that there was the protection for this partly is international attention. Would this march and that whole debate been, would it have been covered more extensively, let's say, in European press more than in North American press?
Good question,
you know, like,
I don't know.
Because we get so little news.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you read about it in alternative press, but
mm-hmm.
it rarely hits national media.
Is anybody aware of this ever being reported in the mainstream media?
Maybe on section K13 of the Sunday paper.
Really?
I guess we don't really live in a country of free press.
Or press with different priorities.
Yeah, it was always the frustration. I mean, the journalists living in El Salvador and working there are very credible people. I mean, the ones I knew and had contact with. But it was always their frustration that what they wrote either was changed so they could hardly recognize it, or was put on page 47 with hardly any headline. So it was just, you know, never, unless they were writing, I mean, some write for alternative sources also, so their material is available in other, you know, the publications, but.
May I ask something? I heard the word peace, freedom,
mm-hmm.
the songs they sing and this sort of thing, but could you define someone that ignorant, you know, of this situation where I think there are quite a few of you people, it sounds as though you've been there, would you define what these factors are, what the different factors are, why?
Why are they fighting?
Okay, I think the basic struggle in El Salvador is over land. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny country with over 5 million people, and so in the last decades and century or so, the development of an agro-export economy, coffee, sugarcane, cotton, beef, grazing land for beef cattle, has meant that most of the land has been expropriated. Most of the peasants, the campesinos, have been pushed off land which they've used to grow beans and corn and rice to feed their families. They've been pushed off onto the hillsides to try and grow a meager, sustain themselves on meager crops. And there's been, over the years, various attempts at organizing themselves and resisting that and pushing for land reform, for some way of regaining their lands. And as that becomes more a stronger movement, and as it links with indigenous groups and with labor groups and so on, who experience other kinds of repression as well, then the repression increases and becomes more and more violent, with death squads, with army attacks, bombings, and so on. And so it just escalates, you know, both sides attacking. So, I mean, that's the basis for the Civil War. And then you get, you know, external interests also. It was played out as being an East-West struggle by U.S. and Canada and Europe for so long, that it was a struggle against communism. But the struggle has not subsided, even though communism has, you know, virtually not disappeared, but close to it in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was always accused of being behind the revolution in El Salvador, until, the Malta summit in December, finally President Bush acknowledged to Gorbachev that he recognized that the Soviet Union was not responsible for sending weapons to the FMLN. And of course, now Nicaragua, with the change in government, is not responsible. Also, that was also the accusation that Nicaragua was supporting the revolution. So even though it's easier to recognize now that it's an internal problem, that it's not other nations intervening or invading and trying to put in a communist government, still the struggle goes on. Support from the U.S. is maintained. So it's evidently for some other reason, and I believe that it's more for economic reasons. Latin America is the backyard for North America. If we didn't have Latin America to exploit, human resources, mineral resources, agricultural resources, our way of life our standard of living would suffer. And so we have to keep the economic order in place in countries like El Salvador. And social change. And also, others that you have.
So really the only country who's intervening in their struggle is the United States, and it's to support our standard of living. Would that be a summary of it?
I wouldn't exclude Canada. I think Canada is, you know, very certainly not as heavily involved, but we're not doing anything to complain or protest U.S. policy there either. I mean, we're in the comfortable and hypocritical situation of not having to look like the culprits and still reaping the benefits. So
what advantages are we reaping? The U.S. and Canada?
Well, specifically from El Salvador, the export products like coffee, sugar, beef. I mean, most of our fast food outlets sell hamburger from that is raised in, if not right in El Salvador, at least maybe Belize or Honduras. 60% of coffee exports from El Salvador are purchased by U.S. companies. And there's been a response, a massive boycott of Salvadoran coffee against, say, Folgers, which is one of the major purchasers of Salvadoran coffee, a Procter & Gamble company. But they've had a lot of pressure from the State Department also to continue business with El Salvador, continue business as usual. So there's not been any response on the part of coffee purchasing companies.
What are the people, the advocates for the poor, what are they trying, how, I mean, what are they doing besides, I mean, what can they do to help the people? Anything?
Well, making the rest of the world aware of what's going on.
So ultimately, the United States has to change its policy to help the poor in El Salvador. Is that?
Are they organizing agricultural co-ops and things like that? Try to get control of a larger portion of the land?
Oh yeah, I mean, the popular organizational movement in El Salvador is phenomenal. It's very large. And that includes labor unions and umbrella organizations of labor unions, agricultural unions. Even, I mean, the coffee union is one of the oldest, the coffee laborers union, and has about 20,000 members. So that's a movement in El Salvador that's perhaps unparalleled in other countries. And that, I presume, is why the repression is so fierce.
It was, quote, the government that went in and took the land from the peasants that started this whole movement?
Well, 14 families traditionally in the late 1800s are the ones who took over the land and from there have developed this agro-export economy. And so the government that's in place is put in place by the wealthy and by U.S. interests to keep that system in place. And now over the war years, years of civil war during the 80s at least, the military have gained more power and more control than the government has. So they kind of set the terms. Well, and they are in a more comfortable position than even business in El Salvador. And so
they enjoy lining their pockets with U.S. dollars.
Yeah. Right. And,
so the military, is the military and the government, are they friendly?
Yes, although the military, I mean, at this point, the government, I think, would seriously and honestly like to offer some concessions in the negotiations, but the military is resisting that fiercely. So any move that the Salvadoran government makes, Cristiani and the Arena Party, toward negotiations, is resisted by the military. And they have said, they've threatened that there will be a very fierce backlash if there should ever be any negotiation, any settlement reached. And anybody, any individual or any figures who play a leading role in those negotiations will then be targeted.
So the military then has been provided expertise, arms, by whom?
By the U.S.
U.S. Russia?
No.
We're the bad guys.
Most of the training for the officer corps in El Salvador happens in the U.S. And all the weapons are sent from the U.S. And the military aid is from the U.S. So if that support continues, then the military will be under no pressure to ease their position on resisting concessions and moving toward a position of negotiation.
Where do these 14 families figure into support of the military?
I don't know, family for family or individual for individual, where they stand. If I presume a lot of them are military figures as well. At this point, I think the business sector is more interested in negotiation because they recognize that the economy is doomed. Because of the sabotage and the violence in the war. So they realize that it's necessary to negotiate and to end the war if business is to continue. So I think probably the 14 families are more in the business sector than in the military.
It all sounds like a feudal society, medieval.
Well, except that in a feudal society, the landowners were responsible for the protection and the care of the
workers. Yeah, and here are the 14 families that have control, but not taking care of them.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Oh, I just want to say that if you are interested in the implications of U.S. lifestyle and the Salvadoran situation, in the Resource Center, I've got a display up on the Folgers boycott, and there's a paper there that there are photocopies of that you can send for information, which will tell you how your church can get involved in this. I would like to point out, though, the Folgers boycott is kind of a symbolic act to heighten our awareness of where our lifestyle does impact the injustice in El Salvador and other similar countries. There's a good background paper there on it that you can read, and you can take a copy of some information to take back to your churches.
Does the lifestyle of the 14 families also affect the total situation?
Mm-hmm.
They're living pretty well.
Oh yeah, there's a minority in El Salvador that are very wealthy.
Yeah, I was down there about a little over 10 years ago, and that was what struck me, just coming from the United States, being very naive about lifestyle and how the world lives, and like you said, there's all the land is just in just coffee. Everywhere you see, it's just all in big crops that are obviously for export, and then when you see where the vast majority of the people, at least what I saw, were living in basically shacks thrown together with sticks and cardboard and tin, no running water, no electricity, family of six living in, you know, a space as big as, you know, that little area that John's sitting in right there that's thrown together with sticks and cardboard. And that's what the majority of the people live in. No land, no nothing. I mean, no nothing. It just shocked me. It was just absolutely shocking, and that's an economic and a social structure that is actively maintained.
And the situation in these 10 years is the same or worse?
I haven't been back. I mean, I'm just sort of
It's getting progressively worse.
So the coffee plantations obviously don't employ very many people. It's all mechanized.